All rise. The judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please go ahead and take your seats. Good morning. We're here for to hear oral argument in United States versus Vasquez. And before we get started, just a couple of announcements. I'm obviously not Chief Judge Orr. He has convened a special panel because, regrettably, Judge Orr had a death in his family this past weekend, and he has traveled to Ohio to attend funerals and make funeral arrangements. So this is a special panel. Judge Roan and Judge Harney were originally part of this, and I'm the newly detailed member of the special panel, again, because of the family emergency that Chief Judge Orr had, so our thoughts are with him. Second, having reviewed the case and discussed this with my colleagues, and given that I believe there were three specified issues in addition to the issues raised, we have decided to offer both sides 45 minutes per side to make sure that the questions of the panel don't eat too much into the time of counsel. And I mentioned that to counsel earlier before we started, and both sides are okay with that. So again, Mr. Caceres, I'll give 45 minutes, and I understand you still wish to reserve five.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, and you're good, Major, with the 45?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. And finally, I'm sure you've noticed how hot it is in the courtroom, and I told both sides as well, feel free to remove your jackets if it gets too warm, especially since we've extended the time. So that's fine if you get warm and need to remove those jackets. So with that, Mr. Caceres.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Members of the court, and before I start, if I may, please pass on our condolences to Chief Judge Orr and his family.
Thank you. We'll do that.
I'm part of the defense team. And, Your Honor, I do appreciate the additional time. And, Your Honor, you and I spoke about very briefly before we started, we will be starting with the specified issues, and I believe that's what the court obviously wants to hear about at this point. Your Honor, the defense position is quite straightforward in this case. As a result of the military judge's actions and the admission of inadmissible hearsay evidence, the appellant's trial devolved into the trial counsel and the assistant trial counsel reading the majority of the government's case to one-third of the panel, depriving the appellant of his due process rights and his constitutional right to confront witnesses, and perhaps as importantly, denying the panel the opportunity to observe the demeanor of the witnesses. And starting with the specified issues, the appellant's due process rights were violated when the majority of the government's case was simply read to the new members of the panel, when the other members of the appellant's court-martial observed the in-court demeanor of the witnesses. Your Honors, I would proffer to the members of the court that in a child sex abuse case, observation of the demeanor of the witnesses is paramount. This was not a case in which the first witnesses were laying the foundation for photographs, so to speak, in which case the panel could simply be read the testimony that says, yes, I took these photographs. These photographs, you know, are a fair replication of what happened or my, you know, of what I observed at the scene. To the contrary, five witnesses, all of whom had critical evidence in appellant's court-martial, testified by the time Second Lieutenant or First Lieutenant Kahn was stricken from the panel. If the court remembers, the first witness, of course, was A.M., the alleged victim in this case. And perhaps most important about her testimony is that she testified by remote location and made drawings of what the appellant allegedly did to her. The court, having read the record of trial, sees exactly what the last two panel members saw, which is you didn't get to observe A.M.'s demeanor as she was making these drawings. And additionally, you did not get to see the trial counsel and the defense counsel sort of scurrying from one room to the next, as is reflected in the record. And if you remember, when the military judge, after A.M. testified, while the original five panel members were there, the military judge made comments to the effect of that nobody had put on the record her gestures during her testimony. And so he did so for the panel members. Of course, only four of those panel members wound up hearing that, as the other two panel members that came in later did not hear that evidence. The second witness was A.M.'s father, Petty Officer Garcia, whose testimony the trial counsel relied heavily on during their closing statement. If you remember, there was some discussion about the timing of events on the day that this incident allegedly occurred. Petty Officer Garcia provided the time frame for which the government alleged the abuse occurred. Once again, four of the six panel members who sat and deliberated on appellant's court-martial saw that witness live. Two did not. The treating physician who relayed to the court, what AM relayed to him. A very crucial witness, and you saw the defense cross-examination of him, which again was not provided to the panel members except for through read testimony. The OSI agent who testified about the pretext phone call, which the government again relied heavily on during their closing arguments, and basically said that it was the nail in the coffin of the appellant's case. And you'll recall that when his testimony was reread, it takes up just a couple of short pages in the rereading of the record of trial to the two new panel members. And finally, Dr. Benedict, who testified as an expert witness. These were, again, Your Honors, not foundational witnesses. These were not, preliminary witnesses. This was the crux, the overwhelming crux of the government's case. Reading of testimony is not trial by jury.
I know this gets at the heart of the specified issues, but didn't the trial judge follow the procedure required by the manual for court martial?
He absolutely did, Judge.
And didn't he also, if I recall, ask counsel if either side had a problem or an objection, I forget the exact word, but with following that procedure, and the response was no?
That is absolutely correct, Judge.
And yet you want us to find that this was plain error?
If you give me two more seconds, that's actually the next step that I'm taking, Judge. Okay? With all of these critical witnesses, one-third of the panel was unable to observe the credibility of the witnesses. Now, Your Honor, you just asked me, what should the defense counsel didn't object, but I would point out, Your Honor, that remember that there are three specified issues. As it relates to the third specified issues, there can be no waiver, because that's the requirement of the military judge to ask the counsel whether or not they want to miss trial. There can be no waiver of that issue, is our position. As it relates to the first two issues, I would hearken this, for lack of a better term, or analogize this to the Harcrow case. The law has changed. At the time of the appellant's court-martial, the defense counsel could not waive what they didn't know exist. And Your Honor, as my co-counsel and I were talking about this morning, one of the points that we made is, it took one counsel in cases of United States v. Foster, United States v. Harcrow, to finally say, this doesn't look right. This is a constitutional violation. So did the defense counsel look at the manual, and did the military judge look at the manual and say, this is what we do? Yes. The law has changed. As it applies to appellant's court-martial, we would argue that RCM 805 is unconstitutional. I'm certainly not going to get up here and tell you that RCM 805 would be unconstitutional under any circumstances. Because, as I said, if it was just a preliminary witness who authenticated some photographs, not an issue. But if you look, Your Honor, and that's why we supplementally cited for the court yesterday the federal case of United States v. Hilliard, we believe that that is a very important case for this court to consider. Because what happened in this case, and as what happened in Hilliard, is that the fundamental nature of the panel changed. I'll get into more of that in a second. Your Honors, I would ask you to consider the dynamics of small groups. And the analogy that I came up with this morning, I do my best thinking very early in the morning, unfortunately, is if the three members of this court, Mr. Lucas, were part of a small group, discussing an item, deliberating on a verdict, whatever, or heard all of the evidence, been sitting in on the entire meeting, and then myself and Major Jansen walked in, what's the first thing that we're going to do? We're going to say, what happened so far? Yeah, I've got the minutes of the meeting, but tell me what's really going on here. In this case, the two new panel members, by logic, are going to walk in and ask the other four panel members how these witnesses appeared. Were they credible? Was AM crying? Did she appear to you to be truthful? Did she appear to you to be genuine? Again, Your Honors, I would point out the uniqueness of a child witness testifying from a remote location with trial counsel and defense counsel going back and forth. It would simply be natural for those two new panel members to ask the other four panel members what happened, because they don't get that with a rereading of the testimony.
They heard her mother's testimony.
They did hear her mother's testimony, absolutely.
Assuming for this question that testimony of her mother about what the little girl said was proper. Assuming for this question.
As you know, we don't assume that.
I know that's a separate issue. Assuming that was proper,
Didn't that provide more detail about what happened? And the members who saw the mother and heard vicariously, I suppose, the little girl's testimony through the mother, wouldn't that be enough?
If it were, Your Honor, there would have been one witness in this court-martial. The government obviously didn't think that was enough. They put on five other witnesses, to bolster that testimony.
It had more detail, though, didn't it, than when the little girl testified?
Making sure I understand your question, Your Honor, the mother's testimony added more detail?
What the little girl told her at the kitchen table or wherever it was.
Yes, Your Honor. No, it absolutely did. But realize that without the daughter's testimony, under your hypothetical, and without the doctor's testimony, under your hypothetical, what do we then have? We have the mother telling the panel of six members now what the daughter told her. Clearly, again, if the government thought that that was sufficient, and it clearly would not have been, that's what they would have done.
I want to go back to your waiver issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
This wasn't objected to at trial. There was opportunity for a significant period of time in which defense counsel could have done this. If Crawford hadn't been announced or decided back in 2004, this case is subsequent. I mean, there is an issue about he had an opportunity to say something he didn't. Isn't that an affirmative decision not to object to the process in place?
I would argue it is not, Your Honor. It is possibly, do we get to a plain error analysis? Probably, and possibly and probably. I have to be candid with the court. But do we get to a waiver analysis? No. And we don't get to the waiver analysis for two reasons. One is because, as I said, you can't waive what you don't know. And two is because under RCM 915 Bravo, the military judge has an affirmative obligation to take certain steps, and he failed to do so. And the best analogy that I could give the court is if you remember years ago, there were a number of cases back when at least some of us in this courtroom started doing this for a living, where usually your defense counsel would enter the forum selection for the accused. That was fairly common back many years ago. 10 years ago or so, 5 years ago, somebody stood up in an appellate courtroom and said, you know what, that's not proper. That doesn't pass the smell test. There hadn't been an objection at trial because the defense counsel had done it. And the progeny of cases that came out after that said, while they looked at it for a structural harm standard, also said this is not waived because this is, the military judge has the responsibility of inquiring personally of the accused what his forum selection is.
What,
and I would argue
that
the same standard
that the
applies.
The defense counsel did not know?
I'm sorry, Judge?
What is it that you're saying the defense counsel did not know?
The case law as it has developed, we would argue, has made RCM 805 unconstitutional. The defense counsel did exactly, Judge, the facts are what they are. The defense counsel and the military judge did what the manual required, with one exception, that being 915 Bravo.
Counsel, government spends considerable time in their brief talking about the Navy case Camacho.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that, of course, you would disagree with the outcome of that case. I would ask you to distinguish that. Why is that case not applicable to the facts here? Because when you read it, you think, well, maybe the Navy got it right. The facts are very similar. The issues were very similar.
I would argue that there are several reasons why Camacho is not binding. First off, it's simply the very nature of the case. In a child sex abuse case, things are different, for lack of a better term. Demeanor of the witnesses is different. Secondly, you're right, Judge. I think the Navy court got it wrong. This probably surprises y'all, but I've disagreed with appellate courts on once or twice in my life, and that's one of them. And thirdly, I think it's the timing of the case. As I recall, Camacho was a few years before this case, and therefore, the law has changed. 10 years ago, if somebody had raised a Fosler objection, many courts probably would have said, not an issue. The law has changed.
But in Camacho, the court said, had there been an objection, they might have ruled differently.
And in this court case, had there been an objection, I'd be a much happier person. But, and Your Honors, if you recall the facts of this case, all of this information was read by the trial counsel and the senior trial counsel. And Your Honor, to get back to your question, I don't believe that was the case in Camacho, but I could be wrong about that. I think defense counsel and trial counsel took turns. But in this case, think about, your experience as litigators and as possibly as trial judges. What happens? The cross-examination by the defense counsel of the alleged victim and of other witnesses is paramount. You get inflection of voices both in the question and in the answer.
Didn't I just ask one question?
I'm sorry, Judge?
You said the cross-examination of the alleged victim didn't...
And others.
I'm sorry?
And others. And other witnesses.
I was talking about the victim. Didn't they just ask one question?
They just asked the one question, but I'm talking about the other witnesses, Judge. Petty Officer Garcia, whose timing of this event was critical. The OSI agent, and if you recall, specifically as it relates to the OSI agent, the defense counsel's cross-examination of him was pretty rigorous. And, of course, you don't get that inflection of voices of either the questioner or the questionee by simply reading the court record. Your Honors, I would proffer that confrontation does not mean only being present when a witness testifies. Clearly, the manual for courts martial envisions circumstances in which non-live testimony is going to be used. Depositions are a perfect example. But it also means that panel members get to determine the credibility of witnesses. I would proffer to the court that in a case such as this, if five of the six panel members were brand new, I would proffer that the results in this case would be pretty simple. If the government had put on their entire case, the defense had put on their entire case, and five-sixths of the panel gets excused, the military judge would not simply ask the trial counsel and senior trial counsel to read back to all five panel members that are now brand new what happened previously. And that's going to lead into the second assignment of error that I'm going to get into in a second. In light of Crawford, you know, and my note that I put in my notes, Your Honor, harkening back to, again, a day that many of us remember, defense counsel are not potted plants. They are not simply there to have their questions and their colloquies with judges read to a panel. There is a reason why we are there. If not, we could simply mail our questions to the trial counsel and say, please ask these questions of your witness once the trial convenes. In light of Crawford, Harcrow, and Rankins, RCM 805 is unconstitutional as applied to the appellant's case. And again, Your Honor, as I look to the Hilliard case, it disturbed the essential feature of the panel as noted in U.S. v. Hilliard. And I would again, Your Honor, hearken back to cases such as Harcrow and Fossler in which defense counsel challenged long-standing procedures which may have been permissible under the manual for courts martial. But as the drafters of the manual have attempted to bring our military courts more closely in line with federal courts, as this rule applied to this case, it cannot stand. Now, Your Honor, I'd like to move on to specified issues 2 and 3. Military judge committed plain error by not declaring a mistrial and violated the clear language of RCM 915B by not inquiring of the parties as to whether a mistrial was appropriate. The standard, again, Your Honor, is plain error, even if the military judge, if the defense counsel did not object. And I would also argue, as it relates to 915B, that the military judges, failure to follow the manual eviscerates the waiver issue.
I know counsel aren't potted plants, but here the plant spoke, didn't it? Didn't the judge ask counsel if they were okay with the procedure, and counsel said yes?
He asked them if they were okay with the procedure. He did not ask them if they wanted a mistrial. And I would think that that is a distinction with a difference, Your Honor, and here's why. Okay. Obviously, the defense counsel spoke on this issue. If not, they would have simply waived any challenge against Lieutenant Kahn and kept him on the panel. But they obviously wanted some relief as a result of this. And the relief that they wanted was for Lieutenant Kahn to be taken off the panel. Okay. So they weren't just sitting there as potted plants. They were at least engaged in the process. But again, Your Honor, we go back to the same thing. The military judge did what the manual allows him to do with one exception, and that is the 915B exception that I'll talk about
now. Could
that have
been a tactical decision that was reasonable for counsel to say, you know what, the little girl's testimony was pretty thin, that's why I only ask one question, the main thing the government has is the mom coming in here with this hearsay testimony, I think I'm going to take my chances?
We don't know that because the military judge didn't do his job, plain and simple.
Well, you said he didn't do his job and yet he followed the rule.
Not as it relates to 915B, Your Honor. I'm talking about two separate things.
The rule under 805.
Under 805, you followed the rule.
So, okay, if you would, and you may be getting into it, can you provide some case law or something that says that the judge had a sua sponte duty under these facts, even though he followed the rule, to say, but you know what, under this circumstance, it just doesn't work out. We're not going to continue.
Are you discussing as it relates to the mistrial issue?
The mistrial.
Okay, and that's where I'm heading, Judge. Okay. There are two operative points here, Okay, 915B says that if grounds for a mistrial may exist, and we take the drafters at their word, it doesn't say if the grounds for a mistrial do exist. And then it says that the military judge shall inquire of the parties. There is one permissive and one mandatory term. As it relates to the issue of whether the mistrial may exist, the military judge, Judge Roman, was clearly on notice. He was on notice that the fundamental nature of this panel had changed. You can tell that by his questions as it relates to the challenges for cause against Lieutenant Kahn, which were the defense would proffer somewhat leaning towards let's try and keep him on the panel. He was on notice because one-third of the panel was new. And the other important issue, Your Honor, is two things that I would like to point out. One is, previously, prior to Lieutenant Kahn being excused, the defense needed two votes for an acquittal. Now, the defense needed three votes for an acquittal. That changes the fundamental nature of the panel. They lost a lieutenant, they gained a lieutenant and a captain. Again, changing the fundamental nature of the panel in violation of U.S. v. Hilliard. The majority of the government witnesses had already testified. So the military judge was on notice that grounds for a mistrial may exist. That's the first prong of the test. The second prong is that he shall inquire the parties. That one's pretty simple. He did not. The military judge never asked the appellant or their counsel if they desired a mistrial. That is the one issue, Your Honor. There is simply no way to unring that bell. There's simply no way to get around the military judge's failure to act. So in conclusion, as it relates to the specified issues, the military judge's actions and RCM 805, as applied to this case, deprived appellant of his due process rights and his right to confront the witnesses against him. This was exacerbated by the military judge's abuse of discretion and admission of his inadmissible hearsay, that I'll be getting to in a second. Any questions as it relates to the specified issue, members
of
the court?
Just one technical
question.
Yes, ma'am. What's the citation to this Hilliard case that you keep referring to?
Your Honor, we filed a supplemental citation yesterday. I don't know if I brought that piece of paper up with me, but I can certainly give it to the court.
Oh, thank you.
And now I can, Judge. See, we are not potted plants.
Do we know
the United States of Hilliard is 701 Fed Second 1052. That's a Second Circuit case from 1983. And it quotes, Your Honor, Williams v. Florida, 399 U.S. 78.
If I could ask, and this may be a softball for you, but under the
can
prior
you move the fences
condition,
in too, Judge?
Yeah, I'm curious about one thing. It's, under the prior addition to the 08 manual, under 805, there was a sentence in the discussion section that said, when you bust quorum like this, essentially ordinarily a mistrial might be appropriate. It used to be in there, probably for the military judge to consider it, as you said, around 915. It was taken out of this particular version. Don't know why. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't, Your Honor. We would be happy to do research the legislative history and supply a supplemental brief, but I don't have an answer
well,
for
could
you.
It be indicative of the intent that they did not want to declare a mistrial under this case because they're following the rules as laid out by Article 29 in RCM 805?
I would certainly proffer that as a possible solution. If I had any idea as to why the drafters of the manual for courts martial did thing, I'd probably be a richer man than I am. So,
just curious.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honors, moving on to the two assigned errors, I'm going to break them into one alpha and one bravo because that's the way that I broke them down in my brief. The mom solicitation of statements from AM, them to the level of testimonial hearsay prohibited by Crawford and its progeny. I would first off proffer that, contrary to the government's assertion, Crawford is alive and well. The military progeny certainly further clarifies that, and I would cite you to U.S. v. Rankins. Your Honors, as you know, there is a three-pronged test under U.S. v. Rankins. We would argue that A.M.'s statement was elicited by her mother clearly with an eye towards prosecution. And I would use this analogy, judges. If OSI had sat down with A.M. at a table and said, tell us what happened when Uncle Ray licked you. Tell me what happened. And OSI took that statement and handed that statement to a prosecutor, frankly, we're probably not having this discussion because any judge would rule that that satisfies the first prong of Rankins. Here, we have a functional equivalent. Again, a distinction without a difference. So instead of OSI taking the statement, Mom takes the statement and delivers it to OSI and to the trial counsel eventually. The second prong is that this was not a routine receipt of unambiguous factual matters. I don't think we need to harp on that. I think that's pretty clearly laid out in our brief. Asking your daughter what she wants for lunch is a routine cataloging of unambiguous matters, not asking her about having been sexually, allegedly sexually molested. And we would again argue that the primary purpose was prosecution, and that ties into the first issue. It is simply illogical to think that her mom was not doing this with an eye towards prosecuting a person that she believed had sexually molested her daughter and that she had recently had a significant run-in with.
Doesn't that indicate that any time the child comes forward and says somebody did something to me, that therefore it's all automatically testimonial? I mean, at the time this little girl, the way the facts came out, in the car, unexpected, I think that's pretty clear, came out with this statement from what I remember. Mom says, wait a minute, let's go back to the house, and then says, what are you talking about? And then, you know, lets the little girl tell her story, lists off the questions about it. To guide her into telling more. Why is that a law enforcement purpose, if you will?
Because of mom's testimony. It's different if, you know, as many parents I suspect would, I think, you know, something we were talking about this yesterday, I think as defense counsel, we sort of put on a different set of blinders when we look at some of these cases. But I don't think it's unreasonable for a mom to say, tell me what happened, and then immediately take a kid to a physician. But that's not what happened in this case. Mom said, I was getting this information from her because I've watched these police shows and I know how to question kids when on a case that may eventually go to trial. We know that because of mom's testimony. I don't know if that answers your question, Judge, but I mean, I think you just look at the testimony itself. Perhaps the bigger issue as it relates to assignment of error one is the admission of AM statements as violated MRE 807. While AM statements to her mother, there is, remember, a three-pronged test, materiality, reliability, and corroboration. While Anne's statements to her mother were clearly material, it was not necessary to admit her statements. The statements were not reliable, and they certainly were not corroborated. Remember the standard under 807, Your Honors. It is a clear indicia of reliability. And if you look at the case law that we cited in our brief, the CAF and this court have come down pretty strongly in their language of that. I mean, it has to be the equivalent of trustworthiness of one of the other rules of evidence. So, for example, you remember in this case, the military judge sort of said what it was akin to an excited utterance, and we would certainly argue that that is not the case since it was some 20-something days after the alleged abuse occurred. That is the standard that this court and the CAF have used, that it has to arise to that level of reliability. Here it was some 20-something days removed from the alleged abuse and some week after the mom had initially been told of the alleged abuse. There was no spontaneity. It was not a week after. It was 20-something days after the alleged abuse. I want to make sure we have the facts right. Staff Sergeant, as it relates to reliability, we would simply argue that Staff Sergeant Garcia's testimony is simply not credible, that she was acting as an unbiased collector of information. No mother would be. And finally, there is a complete lack of corroboration as required under the third prong of MRE 807. So the government may get one of the three prongs. They simply cannot meet the last two prongs of MRE 807. The government attempts, I'm sorry, Judge, do you have a question?
Right.
Okay. The government attempts to link AM's original statement with her statement at the table. This simply can't be done. There is a complete break. You have this sort of, lack of a better term, excited utterance in the automobile, or a present sense impression in the automobile, and then they drive for a while, mom sits down and starts questioning her. There is a significant break in time, and there is a significant break in atmosphere. The government attempts to downplay Staff Sergeant Garcia's anger towards appellant. You should not. You should compare her actions with the prior time AM alleged that she had been sexually abused. If you remember, there was this prior allegation, I don't remember the dates, but that it happened sometime previously, and her mother waited a month to do anything about it. In this case, because of her animosity towards Staff Sergeant, towards the appellant, she, upon finding, questioning her daughter, immediately begins to interrogate her as it relates to the facts of this case. Your Honor, final point that I would like to make as it relates to the MRE 807 issue, you'll recall the government in their brief makes much of the fact that the military judge observed Staff Sergeant Garcia's demeanor and found her to be credible. The defense finds it somewhat ironic that the government thinks that observing the credibility of this witness is extremely important, but for two of the panel members to observe the credibility of five other witnesses is irrelevant. Finally, Your Honors.
Well, let me ask you before you go.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the standard review for 807 is an abuse of discretion, which is a very broad offer for deference to the military judge in making making these decisions.
It is, Your Honor, but if you recall, one of the standards for abuse of discretion is he got the law wrong. In this case, he got the law wrong because the government did not meet two of the three prongs of the test for MRE 807 admissibility. Finally, Your Honors, in my last minute, I think I'm going to have some time reserved. We would like to discuss very briefly assignment of error two, which is a referral to Dr. Harcrow. I didn't even throw down doctor in my notes. I apologize. To Dr. Harcrow. Your Honor, we would argue that the referral to AM, to Dr. Harcrow of AM by a de facto law enforcement agency and family advocacy elevates this and takes this out of the realm of protection of statements to a physician. The obvious purpose here was to continue to build a case. This was nothing short of a forensic interview. There was no allegation of physical abuse. As such, AM statements were not made for the purpose of a medical diagnosis. It was simply another opportunity for her mother to have somebody else hear her testimony and corroborate it for use against the appellant. There is no evidence AM received a medical benefit. There is no evidence AM even thought she was going to receive a medical benefit. Remember that it was some 20 days after the alleged abuse and some 5 days after the report of the alleged abuse. And Dr. Hollander, the defense finds it extremely interesting that the doctor's one of his first comments was, I'm not with OSI. Not, I'm a doctor, I'm here to help you, I'm here to take care of you. It's, I'm not with OSI. Your Honor, he never asked AM if she knew why she was there, and as you know, the case law focuses on the doctor as much as it does on the patient. And we know from AM's testimony that she was not completely unaware of what was going on and as to why she was there, and yet the doctor failed to ask her. I've used up my time. I've reserved a few. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that will conclude our presentation. Judge, I made a bet that I wouldn't be able to use all the time you gave me. I did. Thank you very much.
Glad we extended it for you guys. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Gregory, all members of this court, may it please the court, I'm Major Scott Jansen, and I, along with Colonel Don Christensen, represent the United States in this matter. Subject to this court's questions, the United States will not be addressing the statement AM made to her treating physician. This is classic statements of a patient to a military doctor in the United States, or rely upon its brief for that matter. Well, first, there's four additional issues to discuss. We'll first deal with the statements of the hearsay statements that AM made to her mother, and then we'll move into the questions that the appellant didn't raise, but this court raised on appeal in a special.
Change your focus, because I know for me the question that I'd like to address and take up some time is with
absolutely
specified issues on
sure.
The process.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so if you could begin with your thoughts on that.
Your Honor, and there was three issues. One was dealing with constitutional. This court raised it as a due process analysis. We believe it's more appropriate under a Sixth Amendment analysis, but we will certainly do the Fifth Amendment analysis of that. And then we'll also discuss the 805 Delta and RCM 915 issues. As it relates to both of these issues, the doctrine, the Harcrow doctrine of waiver, absolutely applies. This is not just a situation where the appellant, as to use the court's vernacular, where the counsel were just silent. There was a two-day break in trial. They came back, and the military judge engaged them specifically on this issue. The record makes clear that the appellant's counsel and the government negotiated a way forward. That is waiver, because under Harcrow, trial strategy is that's when the doctrine of waiver applies, and there was absolutely a waiver here. But even if this court were...
I'm sorry, this negotiation of a way forward, was that, do we know this, and I apologize for not knowing this part of the record, but do we know this because the judge perhaps summarized an 802, or how do we know that they negotiated a way forward?
The military judge discussed on the record that, summarizing the record, was that the parties had come to an agreement on the way forward. And this is dealing with the 805 Delta 1 issue. And the United States believes that is evidence that there was an, there was a back and forth negotiation discussion. This wasn't, you know, an issue that kind of comes up where there's a failure to object to an objection at trial. There's a two-day break. They had plenty of time to look at the issues as they wished, and the appellant decided to move forward. We believe that is waiver. However, this court wants to look at the issues a little differently and apply the plain error analysis. The United States believes, even if there was error, there wasn't plain and obvious because the appellant didn't raise it at trial, the military judge didn't raise it at trial, appellant's counsel on appeal didn't raise it at trial, or didn't raise it on appeal, so there's not plain and obvious. And then moving to prejudice.
Just one more thing, and then I'll let you go. On this summary of the 802, I don't have that page of the record up here. Does that give us any insight into counsel's tactics for making the decision that
No, Your Honor. It was a statement that there was an agreement, and this court can consider that to be that there was discussion. It was an intentional act of the parties to move forward. Certainly, if they wanted to, they could have asked for a mistrial, but that wasn't something that was contemplated. They had the opportunity to do so, and this wasn't like there was a failure to object at trial where there isn't trial strategy present. But moving to prejudice briefly, the Jenkins case out of 1983 said it best from the CMA. If there was prejudice, the appellant would have raised it. And the appellant's failure to raise it at trial and the appellant's failure to raise it on appeal is absolutely clear evidence there was no prejudice.
If we look at this from a Fifth Amendment analysis versus a Sixth Amendment, where Harco talks about waiver or forfeiture in the Sixth Amendment context, can you waive a fundamental due process issue? If we look at this as a Fifth Amendment substantive due process question, and I'll get to that in a second with respect to, you know, the panel members, different panel members, can you waive that?
Yes, Your Honor, and the United States cites to the Camacho case. That was dealing, it was decided on a Sixth Amendment issue. That was a case where we'll talk about this more later, but that's a case where basically the entire case went to trial, the government's case, the appellant's case, or the accused case, and the government's rebuttal case. And on appeal, the appellant made an argument that there was a violation of his right to a fair trial, substantive due process and equal protection. That's language more akin to the Fifth Amendment. And the Navy Court in 2003, then a petition denied by the CAF, held that there was no constitutional violation under the Sixth Amendment, and then noted that there was actually a de facto waiver by his failure to object. So the United States believes that Harcro would apply in the Fifth Amendment context or in a Sixth Amendment context.
So I'm looking back to the CMA back as far as 1954, which says that defense failure to object at trial does not waive a denial of a fair trial or a violation of due process of law. And then in other cases, they say it's clear that we may consider error first urged on appeal, which is alleged to violate due process of law and deny to an accused the substance of a fair trial. So if we look at this whole issue as a fairness question under the Fifth Amendment versus confrontation, then your argument about waiver may not be as strong as you're making it out, which is what the Camacho said under Sixth Amendment.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that case. What is that case? And the United States may, the commission of court, file a response on that point.
Okay. Well, I mean, that was the whole. I guess I'm just asking, as a general matter, can you, what the CMA said back then was that even on appeal, you could raise an issue of substantive due process as an error. So why can't you do that here? If we look at, okay, here's...
I guess the concern, the government doesn't believe that there was a violation, it wouldn't be substantive due process, it might be procedural due process under the Fifth Amendment.
Okay. Here's my question, and I will just speak for myself. But the way this thing played out is after five of the six members had testified, you have two brand new members who come into this thing almost after the fact. They're read this testimony. They do not get an opportunity to observe the witnesses, judge their demeanor. I mean, they're not getting the same evidence. Let me go back to deliberate. They do not have the same evidence to consider. And as you pointed out in your brief, many of the existing four members had little children. So it's reasonable to believe that part of that discussion and deliberations was, you know, I saw her. I can tell when a little kid is lying. That type of thing. That's not unreasonable. So how can they be on a level playing field when all six members didn't have that information?
And a footnote to Judge Rohn's question, and then you can go with it all. In the instructions that the judge gave, he tells them to each member to individually evaluate the credibility of the witnesses based on not only what they said, but on their demeanor. For some reason, he failed to tailor that instruction to the rather unique circumstances of this case. For example, like he would have had it been a stipulation of expected testimony and say, hey, you two, remember, you didn't have an opportunity. How can they possibly follow the judge's instruction to independently evaluate the credibility of this critical witness when they didn't see it? How can they possibly do that?
Your Honor, I will try to answer your question. May
I? And again, I'm just following up on Judge Rohn, so I just wanted to package it all up together.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll try to answer it kind of a two-pronged attack. First of all, dealing with sort of the fundamental rights. And dealing with the Sixth Amendment, as the government has had in a couple of cases, in the McCollum case of 03 and the Anderson case of 1999 from CAF, talking about how fundamental rights, the ability to observe witnesses are fundamental rights. And our Superior Court has analyzed this not as a Fifth Amendment analysis, but has analyzed it as a Sixth Amendment analysis, but that those rights are not absolute rights. And Article 29, Bravo, RCM 805, Delta 1, are exceptions to that. Also, going to the Fifth Amendment analysis of sort of procedural due process, in the McDonald case in 2001, one of the ways that the appellant's rights could be violated is if the procedures weren't followed correctly. But the appellant here today admitted that 805 Delta 1 was followed correctly. So there isn't any error there. Now, obviously, if this court were to provide a plain error analysis, then we go through the prejudice, and there isn't any. Even if there was error, that doesn't end the analysis. Then you have to move to the second and third prong, prejudice being the most important.
How does the accused, the appellant in this case, get a fair trial when two of the six panel members didn't have all the evidence? They could not, on a level playing field, be able to discuss what they saw, the demeanor of those critical witnesses, in a fair set? That just couldn't happen in this case.
Your Honor, the United States respectfully disagrees. This is a decision the appellant made and his counsel made to move forward, complying with 805 Delta 1. In addition, reading the Camacho case, the appellant raised the issue of fair trial, substantive due process and equal protection, and our sister service, the Navy Marine Court, addressing that issue, rejected it out of hand. In that case, you had the entire trial, the government's case, and arguably, every witness the government puts on is a critical witness. There are some that are foundational, but they're critical witnesses because they go to the elements of the case. Otherwise, the testimony couldn't be admitted. And so you have all the government's case, all the defense's case, the government's rebuttal case, and then, again, there was no objection, no objection there, but it went up on appeal, and it was held there was no constitutional violation. So the Navy Court did address this issue from a Fifth Amendment analysis, although in addition to a Sixth Amendment analysis.
So what happens if the military judge, for whatever reason, said two of the members, you can't hear or see this piece of physical evidence. We're just going to give you a description of it. Don't know why you do that, but let's say that happened for some odd reason. And then they said back in the deliberation, but you can go with what we told you that physical evidence look like or what it appeared to be. And now you guys go back there and discuss. What's the difference? Here. I mean,
those aren't the facts of this case.
I understand that, but you've got two witnesses who don't have the evidence talking to four others who do. So how do you have a fair deliberation when not everybody is working with the same information? And that to me is a due process question, not a confrontation question.
They had a fair trial because his counsel negotiated that way forward. His counsel also
Can you negotiate away a fair trial? If we were to find, as Judge Rohn is pointing out, that you didn't have a level playing field in that deliberation room, and I'm not trying to make another specified issue here with those instructions, but the instructions essentially told those two members to do something that they could not possibly do. And I got a problem with that, unless we're willing to say, well, the instructions, they're just rote, nobody listens to them anyway. And we know that's not true. It's not supposed to be true.
That's not what the United States is.
But you can't negotiate away a fair trial.
No, that is true, Your Honor. Obviously, the military judge has to ensure that the appellant receives a fair trial. However, for trial strategies, counsel can make decisions, and this wasn't a decision made on the fly. They had plenty of time. But even if there was error, that doesn't end the analysis. You have to then move to the prejudice, and there wasn't any prejudice because there was no objection at trial, which of course gets you to the plain error, and then the appellant didn't raise it on appeal. So I understand that's an issue for this court, but Jenkins is good law that says on the prejudice side, if the appellant's not objecting to it, not raising it, then it's hard to make an argument for prejudice. And again, the United States would cite back to the does this court want the United States to make an argument on the Sixth Amendment?
Well, you certainly can.
But if the court certified or specified the issue as a due process, we don't believe it is. But if this court doesn't think it's a Sixth Amendment, then we won't do that analysis. We provided that analysis to the court because the courts have dealt with this issue more specifically on the Sixth Amendment.
Okay, well, we'll take it to the Sixth Amendment for a little bit. And the question I've got here is, how did, under the facts of this case, did the military judge comply with Maryland v. Craig, Maddox,
Texas,
all of those cases, okay, in which the Supreme Court that one of the cornerstones of the Confrontation Clause is not just the ability for the member to see the witnesses against him, but for the members of the jury to be able to observe and to put it, judge by his demeanor upon the stand and the manner in which he gives his testimony whether he is worthy of belief. And in a case such as this, where you have only one apparent eyewitness to what may have happened, and everything else is built on testimony or discussion with the little girl, how did that cornerstone of the Confrontation Clause get met? How were the members able to, all of the members, able to judge the demeanor of those witnesses?
Your Honor, this court, in two cases, McCollum in 2003, saw this court, the Court of Appeals in 2003 in the McCollum case and Anderson case, dealt with this issue and held that the right to be able to evaluate the demeanor of witnesses is a fundamental right but not an absolute right. And if you look at the Craig case, there's a Supreme Court case, I don't have it here in front of me, dealing with that issue again, that the Supreme Court says it's a fundamental right but it's not a right that is not an absolute right. And
okay, what does it give it up to then? What's the overriding government interest in not having all of the members observe witness?
Well,
and that's what happened in Maryland v. Craig. It says the child victim could testify, you know, remotely behind the screen, as in the McCollum or Anderson, and they said that was necessary. But in doing that, the members were still able to see, hear, and observe that child victim. That's not what we have here.
That is correct, Your Honor. And having all the members observe the demeanor of the witnesses is the preferred method. But the fact that it's not, doesn't always occur, doesn't mean that there's a constitutional issue. As this court is well aware, hearsay, any type of hearsay statement, isn't subject to confrontation, isn't subject to witnesses observing demeanors, but hearsay is admitted all the time, and sometimes significant hearsay. And so it is a right that should be afforded. In most cases it is, but just because when there are instances where that is not permissible, the Congress in Article 29, and the President in RCM 805 Delta, and this court, many courts have held that there isn't a constitutional violation when that doesn't occur.
But here it seems to me it's going back to, as Judge Rohn said, a level playing field. here there's a disparity in this panel, isn't there, between some who got to see the little girl and others who didn't. And I think the numbers were 4 and 2. 4 got to see, 2 didn't. Mm-hmm. 4 is required to convict. I think we can pretty well guess what happened in that deliberation room. And I think that's the problem here, is you don't have a level playing field. Doesn't that go toward the fundamental fairness aspect of this?
Well, Your Honor, the United States doesn't believe that I apologize, I just lost my train of thought. The fact that it didn't occur, the United States believes that it does not change the fundamental nature of the trial. In particular, because the appellant approved of the procedure, so that has to be taken into consideration when this court is making a determination. Again, whether there was error, but even if there was error, that doesn't answer the question. And so there are many times where a court will hold that things didn't occur as they were supposed to, but at the end of the day, looking at the prejudice, there was no prejudice. So,
but again, as I'm trying to understand this, what's your view on how this obvious disparity in what each member had available to them as far as evidence affect your analysis of whether this was fundamentally fair? 4 got to see the critical witness. 2 didn't.
Well, Your Honor, I would draw this court's attention back to the Camacho case, and that's a case where they didn't all. If this court were to construe it as being some sort of fundamental fairness, or there wasn't equal playing field, and the court held specifically that there wasn't a violation of a due process right, a fair trial, and that's a case where the entire case was done by paper, essentially, and so this court can follow the Navy Marine Court's decision in Camacho wholeheartedly and reach that conclusion that there was no violation of his fundamental rights, due process, right to confrontation on both the Fifth and the Sixth Amendment, and the Camacho case tees it up exactly like how this case is. The court says the gist of the appellant's argument is that, in effect, two different panels received the evidence in very different ways. The old panel of 2 members having had the opportunity to observe the demeanor of all the witnesses, with the new panel of 2 members not having that opportunity. Thus, under the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, the appellant was deprived of her right to have the finders evaluate the demeanor of these witnesses. But the court held that there was no Sixth Amendment right, that 805 Delta 1 was followed appropriately and followed correctly, and the appellant agrees with that.
I'm sorry, what were the numbers in Camacho? Not to get too far down in the weeds on that, but what was the split? The number of panel members who saw evidence and the number of panel members who didn't see evidence and the total number of panel members?
I think it was 2 and 2.
So not enough to convict the ones who saw the evidence.
That would be correct, Your Honor. But
We have here.
But what's that, Your Honor?
Unlike we have here. 4 saw enough to convict out of 6, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But the court didn't. That wasn't a key consideration in the court's decision. Mm. I may move to.
The judge has more than the duty to be a referee, is how the appellate court has said it. He's also got to ensure a fair and just trial. So, taking up the appellate defense's argument, why didn't the military judge have a sua sponte duty under 915 to declare a mistrial of the case, or at least in the minimum inquire specifically? We don't know what was said behind closed doors, if anything, about this issue. So why didn't he have a duty on his own to say, this is one of those cases that we need to declare a mistrial or consider a mistrial?
Well, Your Honor, the United States believes that issue wasn't raised, that if it was raised, the military judge was an engaged military judge, and apparently counsel were engaged as well. So if it was raised, then he would have the military judge would have discussed it on the record. His failure to discuss on the record indicates that it wasn't raised, and that's the position of the United States. And
well, going same question back I gave Ms. Fitzgerald, under the old version of the manual, there was a provision in there that specifically said, or was a discussion point that said, a mistrial might be appropriate. Now, it's not there, but it certainly that concept certainly does not go away under these facts. So why wouldn't it be appropriate for the judge to have said, this is just one of those cases, unique cases, where we have to consider a mistrial?
Well, Your Honor, again, draw the court back to the Camacho case, and that was actually the question that was discussed in the Camacho case, because as the court has noted, there is a distinction between 2005 and 2008 edition, but that concept is discussed in the Camacho decision, and this court held, or excuse me, the Navy court held that was not a violation. And dealing specifically with that concern of the court of not raising it or raising the mistrial when you have an 805 Delta 1 or Article 29 concern. In terms of mistrial, in terms of mistrial under 915 Alpha, the case law is very clear. It is an unusual and disfavored remedy. It's a drastic remedy and it certainly wouldn't apply here. In part because the appellant didn't raise it and he could have raised it, then at that point it would have been appropriate for the military judge to engage. But the United States believes that under the facts of this case, and not speculating beyond the facts of this case, it wasn't raised.
What about your case? Well, that's a good analogy.
Let me just ask a hypothetical about it. Let's assume that instead of this situation where the lieutenant was dismissed for cause after five or six witnesses. Don't worry, we'll be back. Let's assume that didn't happen. But in this case, the lieutenant in question was seated, Governor Wardire was seated, and then became sick. And the military, he's too sick to continue. The military judge said, you know what, we've got witnesses lined up, we've got to get this case done. So what we're going to do, only five members, is Lieutenant, you're going to go home, you're going to get better, and we're going to continue this case. And when you recover, we're going to stop the proceedings and we're going to read to you the witness testimony that you missed. And in my example, the same situation happens, he misses five of the six witnesses. He comes back, the judge says, okay, here's what took place.
There would be a violation of probably, I don't have the citations in front of me, but there would be a violations of many RCMs related to that. But again, Your Honor, those aren't the facts of this case.
But my question is, what substantively is different? I realize there's procedurally, RCM 805, Bravo, I think, says the judge cannot do a continuum. Article 29 says you can't continue in a court-martial without all members present. But substantively, and as, you know, as a matter of reality, what is the difference between my hypothetical and that missing member getting the information after the fact, and in this case, where the two new members come in after they've testified and are read to them the testimony? What's the difference in those two scenarios? Notwithstanding the RCM saying you shouldn't do it, I want to know the difference in the scenarios.
Your Honor, the government's answer would depend in part on whether or not the appellant agreed with that procedure.
Appellant didn't bring it up.
Well, in this case, the United States believes that it's more than just not bringing it up, but there is actually some deliberative thought in the process of moving forward. So that is a key consideration that would fundamentally change this court's question. But the United States answer to this court's question.
The substantive is the same situation, right? One we would have to overturn because it violates any number of RCMs in Article 29, and one you want us to allow because it's not prohibited by the rules. But the effect on the members is the same, and I guess your argument would have to be that substantively, in either situation, the appellant received a fair trial.
Yes, Your Honor, in part because there was agreement by the opponent or by the appellant for moving forward. And also this court, the questions this court has relates to whether there was error or not, not whether there was, assuming for the sake of the argument, that waiver doesn't apply here, and that eliminates the issue at all for an appeal. It still doesn't go to the issue of prejudice when, in the Jenkins case, it makes very clear that when the appellant's failure to object, failure to raise the issue, eliminates prejudice. So in a case like, as a court has raised, and this, it came up on this court, and this court will determine if there was error, that doesn't end the analysis. You'd move to the prejudice, a prejudice analysis, or actually the plain error analysis, because at that point it would become pretty clear there'd be need to discuss further some of the RCM and constitutional issues. But here, that didn't occur, so it wasn't plain and obvious to all the parties.
So your argument is there's no prejudice when two of the four members don't receive the same evidence, as happened in this case.
Absolutely not. No prejudice, and the appellant didn't even raise it as prejudice, so therefore this court can assume that there was no prejudice. Clearly he would have if he chose to. There's only one remaining issue, and that was the United States. Unless, does this court have any concerns about the statements to the medical doctor that...
You're asking questions about the doc.
Okay. So we'll set that aside. Dealing with residual hearsay to the mother... Actually, if I can, I'm going to go back briefly to make some comments about what the appellant raised, talking about can't waive what you don't know, that Harcrow, one of the principles of Harcrow is that you can't waive a constitutional right you don't know about in the cases where constitutional rights are prescribed later by our superior court. But this case, RCM 805 Delta, Article 29 and 915, those doctrines, principles apply pre-Crawford. And the court, the appellant also tries to kind of merge concepts of Crawford being the right dealing with hearsay and testimonial nature of hearsay, and members being removed and going forward. Those are fundamentally two different concepts, but... So when the appellant raises, you know, what law changed, and never answers that question. The law hasn't changed. All of the procedures moving forward have been in place pre-Crawford and for a long time. I would assume it was implemented back when the UCMJ was, I don't have that research on that, but I would assume it was when the UCMJ was enacted, and then the first RCMs were promulgated. Moving to the residual hearsay of the mother, the first step in the analysis is whether or not the statement was testimonial. I mean, that's the Crawford case. If it is testimonial, then obviously there'd be an error here, and then we would move to the harmless beyond reasonable doubt analysis. But the United States believes that there was no error in this case. So it was not, the statements of the mother were not non-testimonial. When they're non-testimonial, the court looks to the Ohio versus Robert, the pre-Crawford analysis, which is the indicia of reliability. And there's two problems to that, the firmly rooted residual, the firmly rooted hearsay, which would be the normal hearsay rules, which the statements to military doctor or to treating physician would apply. And the next one is a particularized guarantee of trustworthiness, and that's going to be the residual hearsay. In Rankin, our Superior Court, and then more recently in Sweeney, adopting the Rankin analysis, provides that there's three prongs to determine whether or not, the three factors to consider whether or not a statement was testimonial. And the appellant is raising an issue with the third one, whether or not the statement was made with an eye towards trial. And it makes a big deal, appellant does, about how the mother was acting like OSI. The mother wasn't acting, she's not OSI, she's a mother and would do what every mother or grandmother or aunt or friend would do if someone came and reported a serious incident of a sexual nature. South Sergeant Garcia was understandably concerned about her daughter's safety. And it's important to look at, you could look at just her own testimony on this issue. She never makes mention in her testimony about desiring to go to OSI or security forces.
Well, what else do you think she was going to do with it?
She went to family advocacy, and there was a discussion. If you look at the testimony, her testimony, and then her husband's testimony, and there was a discussion when they got back, and he's like, you know, you need to take her and get her help. But where does she go? She goes to family advocacy, not to law enforcement, and that is indicative of this court can consider whether or not that was an eye towards a trial. This case is very similar to the Russell case and the Army case the government cited. Sort of 5-year-olds making a statement to a friend's mother about sex games with father. They have sort of initial discussions, and they have some discussions later. In that case, the Army held it was a mother interested in the safety of her daughter and not being a police officer. And in the Sparks case, this is a recent case out of the Navy Marine Corps of 2011, where it's a 4-year-old gets a report from her grandmother, and the court holds that the grandmother is acting like a grandmother. And even in the Justice case, most recently by this court, I know it's unpublished, but it was recently decided by this court, dealing with statements to a social worker, and how, under the facts of the case, statements to a social worker were not statements to a police. Here, we're not talking about a social worker. We're talking about statements to a mom. And where else would a 4-year-old likely go but to her mom? And so the United States believes that under no circumstances were these statements going to be testimonial in nature. They were not law enforcement questions and not law enforcement intended focus. Now, that doesn't end the analysis. Then we have to move, the government has to move to residual hearsay.
You're running out of time, so let me focus a question on you.
About 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, let me just ask this. One thing that happened was unusual in this case is the little girl was permitted to testify after laying out that she understood right from wrong and lying from telling the truth. The military judge permitted her to testify. And then all of a sudden he found that she was not competent to testify with respect to what she may have told the mother, and thereby allowing Staff Sergeant Garcia to bring in the hearsay testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's just, what's the basis for finding that she's competent to testify about the ultimate act she says occurred, but she's not competent to testify about what she may have told her mother?
Well, Your Honor, I think the government answered a couple ways. One is that starting off, the appellant doesn't raise her competency. The court noted that the United States argued competency is different than unavailability for the admissibility of a residual hearsay. Those are two, and this court should analyze those issues differently. I know this is a unique case, but it's proper to analyze each one sort of separately, and this court can hold that there was the opportunity for cross-examination, so those statements that the daughter made were admissible, in part because there was no motion to strike that language. Now, as it relates to unavailability or didn't appear, then a military judge There was no objection on the unavailability side of things. So those are two. Confrontation, the right to confrontation, is different than unavailability. In the court, the United States would analyze those issues separately. There isn't an overlap.
I think you, I'm looking for it in the brief, but I think you cited a case, U.S. v. Rose, in support of this argument. And I haven't had a chance to read it, so how does that case support Judge Rohn's question to you why the child could be allowed to testify in a limited circumstance and then be found unavailable later on, therefore allowing the residual hearsay to come in through the mother? I know I saw it in here somewhere.
Yes, sir. I think the government made the argument that if this is not this is one argument of the government, that When you have the opportunity to cross-examine a witness and you choose not to, then that eliminates the issue of Crawford, and the statements then would be admissible, and Crawford isn't applied. And
what case law are you citing for that proposition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, it was cited in the brief. When you have the opportunity to cross-examine, and you don't. And here, the appellant had an opportunity to and chose not to because, I mean, there was an opportunity, but...
We had an opportunity to cross-examine with respect to what she said she claimed happened, but where was the opportunity to cross-examine what she may have said to the mother?
The opportunity.
The judge said she wasn't available.
Your Honor, the way the trial went was the first question the appellant asked was, "Do you remember me?" She says yes. Then defense counsel asked for a break. There was a break, a period of time. Came back. Military judge said, and the appellant said, "There's going to be no further questions." At that point, actually, that determination of unavailability wasn't made then. It was made later in the trial. But there was the opportunity. The appellant chose not to. Perhaps it would have become unworkable in the eyes of the court moving forward in the cross-examination, but that just didn't happen here. The appellant made the decision not to continue cross-examining prior to that potential. It could have happened. So the United States believes that...
So before the judge made his ruling, defense counsel should have known to cross-examine her on something that they objected to on the 807 grounds. The judge hadn't ruled. They should have known to cross-examine her about statements made to the mother, even though she said nothing about that during her direct. So what you're saying is because they didn't do that, it was waived? The judge up to that point had not made any decision with respect to whether he was going to allow the 807 testimony to come in.
Correct.
So, I'm just trying to follow your thing. I'm not arguing, I'm just trying to follow it. What you're saying is they, by not cross-examining the little girl right after she testified with respect to what she claimed happened, he also waived the cross-examination or his opportunity to cross-examine her with what he may have said to the mother, what she may have said to the mother?
The government is arguing that the opportunity and the waiver is dealing with the confrontation, the Crawford confrontation analysis. Now dealing with the residual hearsay, the court, the United States believes that this court should do the entire analysis under residual hearsay. And residual hearsay, when you're dealing with children, the court has made it clear that the military judge is given considerable discretion, and that's in the Kelly case, the Donaldson case, and the Wellington case the government has cited, considerable discretion to admit residual hearsay of a child abuse victim making a statement to his or her mother or adult. And under just the plain reading of the residual hearsay, there's five criteria, and courts have used different criteria, but they all boil down to about three things: materiality, necessity, and reliability. And in the Idaho versus Wright case, the Supreme Court case, laid out four factors: spontaneity and constant repetition. This is the picture of what a spontaneous statement would be to a mother in the car and then at home, following up and having more conversation about that. Mental state of the victim is important. So there's four: spontaneity and constant repetition, mental state of the victim, use of terminology unexpected or expected of a child witness, and the lack of motive to fabricate. And the mental state of the victim, normally the mother testified that she's a very happy child, but when she made this reporting, she was very serious and troubled, and that is key information. Lack of use of terminology. She used terminology of licking. That's something a 4-year-old would be able to comprehend what had happened. And lack of motive to fabricate. And the military judge made specific findings of fact, and so that gets us to the abuse of discretion a standard. And the military judge found there was no evidence of A.M. being rebellious, not prone to lie. And the appellant himself, when he testified, He testified that there was no reason to believe that Staff Sergeant Garcia had any reason to testify untruthfully, to make things up, to frame him. And there's nothing in the record indicating that AM had any knowledge of bad blood or motives to lie or rebelliousness. And so the military judge made specific findings of fact.
Before the clock runs out on you, I want to give you the flip side of the question I asked Mr. Caceres regarding prejudice. If we were to find that the hearsay statements of the little girl were properly admitted, and we focus on these couple of members not being able to actually see the little girl testify, if the hearsay provided so much more detail than what appears to be the rather limited testimony of the little girl, where's the prejudice in these members not seeing the little girl, because they got everything and more from the hearsay through Staff Sergeant Garcia, which they did see? However, in your brief, you seem to argue, or you make a point that seems to go the other way, that there is still prejudice, because even though the judge found that she didn't appear in the sense of Crawford, in your brief, let me see, where is it? Oh, page 37, you say, AM's testimony alone, albeit short, met both elements of the charge. So you're saying her testimony alone, even if Sergeant Garcia had never testified, was sufficient to convict this
Absolutely, Your Honor.
This fellow.
There's only two elements, one that the appellant engaged in sexual contact with a child, and the acts committed against a child were not, the child not, already had not become age 12. And in her statement, there's other evidence out there that would be important testimony, but just based upon that sort of limited testimony of AM plus other testimony of other witnesses would be for non, I guess you'd have to parse out some of the testimonial side of the testimony of Sergeant Garcia, but there would be some testimony in there that perhaps would be still admissible on appeal, consider on appeal, but statements of the appellant that he made to the in the limited statements that he made to the during the pretext phone call, the statements of Staff Sergeant Petty Officer First or Second Class Garcia, the appellant's own statements that there's no reason to think that there's anybody out to get him, that would be enough. It would be a closer call, admittedly, but under legal and factual sufficiency, there would be sufficient evidence.
So your position is that AM's testimony alone, perhaps with some corroboration from these other peripheral witnesses, but her testimony satisfied the elements and was enough to convict?
Yes, Your Honor. However, the United States believes, for the reasons we've discussed today and in our briefs, that there was no violation. Certainly, having the statements of the mother would be helpful, but
my point is, I'm getting back to the other issue. If this little girl's testimony alone was enough to convict, then that seems to make it extremely critical that all the members had a chance to see her and independently assess her credibility, as the judge told them to do, which, as I think we agree, it was impossible for them to do.
Yes, Your Honor, but that still doesn't end the analysis. The analysis has to then move to into prejudice, and again,
that's what I'm asking this question for. Isn't there prejudice if the one person they didn't see was enough to convict? Doesn't that say, gee whiz, maybe there was some prejudice there?
Your Honor, the United States respectfully submits that there was no prejudice.
Oh, okay.
So if I may briefly conclude.
Sure.
Judge Gregory Allen, members of this court, the military judge did not abuse his discretion admitting the testimony of AM's mother and a treating physician about what AM told them about what the appellant did to her. And there was no constitutional error continuing the trial following the seating of two additional members as was negotiated by the parties. Finally, mistrial issues were not raised during the trial, so there was no requirement for the military judge to sua sponte declare a mistrial or to raise the issue with the parties. And for all these reasons, the United States respectfully requests this honorable court affirm the conviction, the appellant's conviction, and his sentence. Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Caceres, I think you've got some time reserved.
I do, Judge.
Your Honors, I'd like to start off with some preliminary matters. Quite frankly, Judge Roan, I think that your questions rose in my brain, the fact that we may have misconstrued the court's assignment of first specified issue. Candidly, we would invite the court, if you would so desire, we'd be happy to rebrief that issue from the perspective that you were looking at, which is more the due process perspective than the Fifth Amendment perspective than the Sixth Amendment. So we simply offer that to the court should the court so desire. Judge Gregory, I wanted to pose a hypothetical to you.
Uh-oh. On the hot seat.
You are in the position of the two new panel members that came into this case. As a result of tragic events, you were appointed to this case relatively recently. I would submit, with all due respect, Your Honor, that if this court were to have to make a decision today, you would be at a significant disadvantage.
I would ask for a delay.
And the judge in this case did not grant a delay. The remedy to you would be to ask for a delay. The remedy at trial is to grant a mistrial. Because the two people coming onto the case, just as you coming onto the case today, are at such a significant disadvantage as it relates to the evaluation of the evidence in this case. I would also submit that my reading, my 50-page brief, and the government reading their 100-page brief to you, would not be an appropriate substitute for exactly those reasons. Judge Harney, I wanted to turn to one question that you asked as it relates to the Camacho case. I would point out to you that the Camacho case preceded Crawford v. Washington by a year. That is an important distinction. Not only did it precede Crawford by a year, but CAF's denial of a petition for review also preceded Crawford. So when you ask me what the difference is I don't believe that Camacho would be decided the same way today, both as a result of Crawford and as a result of the due process analysis. Judge Harney, I believe it was either you or Judge Roan that asked about the substance of how it came to be that the military judge announced everybody's come to an agreement. There's really very little evidence in the record as to what happened.
I was asking about that 802 summary, yeah, just to see if that gave us some insight into the tactical thought process of the counsel.
And there isn't. And he doesn't even announce it as an 802. As you recall, as you know, Judge, normally it would be, we've had an 802. This is what happened. Counsel, is there anything else you would like to add to the record? He doesn't even do that. He simply says, everybody's come to an agreement. This is what we're going to do. So again, I believe that that is an important distinction. And Your Honor, one more thing before I move on to the remainder of my argument. As you asked about, Judge Gregory, you asked about the instruction. And I believe it's also critical to note in this case that this is one of those cases, and I know not all judges do it, but the judge did provide the instructions to the members. And that's at Record of Trial pages 728 and 729. So as they're going back and looking at that instruction, which says, or considering that instruction, which says, you all have the same responsibility to judge the credibility of the witnesses, I don't believe it is a stretch to say, well, maybe some of the panel members said, well, how do we do that? Because we didn't see the same witnesses that you did. Well, here's the paper. Here's what the guy in the robe, who knows everything, according to the panel members, and according to me, of course, those judges as well, says, this is what we're going to do. We all have to judge the credibility of these witnesses the same. The fact that these members were provided instructions in writing, I believe, is a very relevant factor for this court to consider.
How do you think it's possible for them to comply with the instructions?
It's not. Does that answer your question, Judge?
That was a softball.
And you even moved the fences in for me a little bit, so that's good. Judge Ron, turning to your Fifth Amendment due process question, the law has always been, you're correct, that if you cannot waive a due process right. And I was thinking about this hypothetical. What if, for some bizarre reason, the defense counsel said, you know what, instead of having a trial, we're just going to read the Article 32 testimony of all the witnesses to the panel members. We'll just forego the entire trial. And I have a tactical reason as to why I want to do that. There's no way a judge would allow that to happen without declaring a mistrial. And if he or she did not declare a mistrial, there is no way that this court would not say that that is a violation of the appellant's due process rights. I would again point this court to the Hilliard case. The distinction between Camacho and the Hilliard case and between this case and the Hilliard case is that in Hilliard, as happens in federal district court, the alternate panel members sat through the trial. And yet, the court still said that it affected the fundamental makeup of the panel. That's a very important distinction, because this is not a case where the two panel members, they didn't have, you know, closed circuit testimony, or the testimony wasn't recorded for them. They were read a cold and sterile record. Government counsel incorrectly states that we say that 805D1 was followed appropriately. We do not. We say it was followed as to the letter of 805D1, but it does not exist in a vacuum. RCM 915 is just as much a part of the manual as RCM 805, and therefore RCM 805 was violated when the military judge failed to declare a mistrial sua sponte or failed to inquire of the parties as to whether a mistrial was appropriate.
Do you think it's plain error for the judge not to raise and declare a mistrial on the basis of the facts of this case? You're not saying that 805 is somehow on its face unconstitutional. You're just saying that's applied here. The judge should have recognized that it's a foul.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I believe 805 is unconstitutional as it applies to this case, and that's why I gave you the hypo earlier where I said, if the first witness had done nothing but lay the foundation for four photographs and leaves, clearly it would not be inappropriate for the panel to, you know, for them to bring in new panel members and say, I looked at these four photos, that's what they are, and admit them. But under the unique facts of this case, RCM 805 is unconstitutional, and the military judge erred by not sua sponte declaring a mistrial or inquiring of the parties. Your Honor, Judge Rohn, I wanted to point out to your question as to the change in the manual, having had at least a few seconds to think about it. I would point out that the old version of the manual, while it did have that language in there, is that requirement is not eliminated by the new version. It's simply not mentioned. So there was nothing, you know, I believe that if the drafters had intended that this remedy would not be available, they would have said, no longer shall you inquire. In fact, it's not even available under these circumstances. That's clearly not the case that we have. Finally, Judge Rohn, I'd like to turn to your last hypo, which is, what if Lieutenant Kahn had come down sick at the beginning of this trial? I would actually disagree with both you and my opposing counsel that this would fundamentally, that this would violate the manual. Because the military judge, under your hypo, said, you're still a member of the panel, so we haven't fallen below quorum. And while the manual requires that five people, that the quorum be five people, I don't believe in your hypo that one of the witnesses going home for a couple of days per se would violate the manual. Would that be acceptable to this court? Absolutely not. Would it be acceptable to our superior court? Absolutely not. But and I think that that is an important distinction, because just as in that case where he followed the tenor, or at least the letter of, the manual for courts martial, he did not follow the spirit of the manual for courts martial, for lack of a better term. So while that Lieutenant Kahn may have still been a member under your hypothetical, I believe that this court would not allow that to stand. Under this scenario, it is a distinction without a difference, because we now, in fact, it's even a better, even a greater distinction, because we have two panel members replacing the original one, not one. Your Honor, you asked a question about the questioning of AM, in which the defense counsel only asked one question of AM, and then we devolved that into the discussion about RCM or MRE 807. I would submit to you that we have no idea at all of knowing whether or not that defense counsel would do the same thing if he had the six panel members that he wound up with as opposed to the five that he started with. These are tactical decisions that defense lawyers make all the time based on the composition of a panel. When the panel composition fundamentally changes, as per U.S. v. Hilliard, it violates due process, it violates the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, and this court should reverse.
Subject seems to any, like if he felt that way, though, he would ask for a mistrial.
It would seem that if he felt, I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't quite
hear. If he felt that way, though, that, oh, gee whiz, I would have had an entirely different cross had I known this was going to pan out this way, then he would have asked for a mistrial.
I disagree, Judge, and I disagree because, again, just as in Joe Drone's scenario, where one panel member, theoretically, if they got sick and went home for a couple of days, you would still have a quorum, I believe that the defense counsel in this case, looking at the rules, says, well, it may stink, but that's what I'm stuck with. Your Honor, I'm not going to delve into the other, the assigned errors, unless the court has any further questions in regards to MRE 807 or...
Just to go back to very first...
Yes, Your Honor.
When you stood up, I mean, the specified issue that we gave was whether the appellant's due process rights were violated. Not just confrontation, but due process.
I understand, which is why I've offered the opportunity to further brief the issue.
Well, I'm not sure what... wasn't clear about.
Well, I,
the specified issue.
I'm not
taking the Sixth Amendment.
I'll take the hit, Judge. We misread.
Okay, just making sure.
Yep, and we'll be happy to rebrief it should the court so desire.
I think that's all the questions we have.
Thank you very much, members
of
the court.
Thank you. Thank both sides for your excellent arguments as well as your flexibility in dealing with our specified issues and questions on those. And the case is submitted.
Thank you, Judge.
All rise.